Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for your continued support. As always, hit that subscribe button, everybody. We have an amazing show for you all, because born the mothership is Kurt Farquhar. You know him as the composer for Black Lightning and the King of Queens. He now scores First Kill on Netflix. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars.
Hello, Mr. Farquhar. Thank you so much for coming to the First of the Stars podcast.
Hi. Nice to see you.
Definitely a pleasure to talk with you, sir.
Pleasure being here.
So I always start off with a question of inspiration. So what inspired your love for music and who were your earliest influences?
Wow. What inspired my love for music? I don't remember a time when I didn't love music. I started hearing sounds and melodies in my head when I remember as far as 3 years old.
Oh, wow.
Humming things, old melodies over and over again. And I've never been able to stop it completely. I can tamp it down, but I can't stop it ever. Mm. It's constantly going on in my head 24 hours a day. Inspirations. I love Claude Debussy. I love Miles Davis and Keith Jarrett. Are really, really big inspirations for me. And I love so many artists that just do them and just do special stuff, you know, where they're not just totally relegated to the norms of what of their times, like Charles Ives is one of my all-time favorite composers, because he didn't relegate himself to what was going on in those days. I mean, and therefore this guy, presupposed virtually every major innovation in music except for electronics, you know? I mean, and while working as an insurance salesman, insurance executive. So, I mean, go figure.
So going back to what you said about hearing music in your head, is it just that you have a great memory for music that's played, or do tunes and melodies just come to you like that?
Tunes and melodies are going on consistently in my head, original ones. I'm almost never am humming something, a tune of somebody else's. That every now and then I do, and that's a relief actually to me. And then but it's constantly some sort of, like, there's a score going on right now in my head. Fully realized.
Just to go into explore that a little bit. So when you're hearing the tunes, are they situational? Like, for instance, since you're on Traversing the Stars podcast, is this something tuned towards this, or is this literally, or is it just not only generic, but like just various melodies, or are they moment specific for you?
It's constant melodies, and it isn't in one particular direction. Unless I'm writing and I'm pushing it in that direction. Sometimes I try to tamp it down so it doesn't just make me crazy, my head explode from constantly hearing this. But there's just a constant level of sound and melodies. And sometimes when I first started dating my wife, she says, you're just humming all the time. And a lot of times I'm just like, it's just, it gets out of my head and I'm just starting to sing it. And so it's really a good thing that I do have the job that I do, because I don't know what I would do if I was like this and I wasn't a composer. I mean, could you imagine how painful? I think back to an old Star Trek episode back in the 60s where these aliens, to drive these people crazy, they would place a melody in their heads and they couldn't stop it. It was just driving them nuts. I said, oh my God, I remember when I came in, I said, that's me. Okay, I got it explained now.
Well, like I said, like, thank God you have this job, because if you were like a lawyer or something during court when the other prosecutor or whatever is talking, just in there humming along to your melodies randomly.
Can you imagine? I mean, and that's literally, my mom wanted us all to play instruments, but we weren't actually supposed to be musicians. We were supposed, she chose her, all of our careers, and you'd supposed to be a doctor or a lawyer, and I was supposed to be an attorney. But
really?
That didn't work out. It didn't work out with any of us. We all ended up being relatively creative.
But I mean, your musical education is immense. So once again, I tend to research my my guests. And so you attended the Berklee College of Music in Boston, the National Conservatory of Music in Versailles, France, Eastern Illinois University. So how did this accumulation of education make you a better musician? Did it affect how you heard music in your head or how you approached it? What benefits did each academic institution have on you as a composer and musician?
Well, first of all, I never studied composition at any one of those schools, and each of them was, especially Berklee and Versailles Conservatory were known for composer. I mean, Claude Debussy went to the Versailles Conservatory, and I studied and studied to learn things, to find out what other people were doing, and to find out, you know, because I thought that that's what I was supposed to do. And I spent my whole childhood doing that, studying everything that I could learn to push me forward musically. And I've spent my entire adult life trying to forget it all. it's always the chicken and egg thing. What came first, you know? Did the music come first, or did the music theorists who come and tell you what they did? You know, if the theorists came first, then there would never be a Charles Ives. There would never be a Debussy. Debussy was literally kicked out of the Versailles Conservatory for doing exactly the thing that he won the Prix de Rome the very next year. So, you know, there could be a big case for, you know, being you, like I said in the very beginning of the interview, being you. Miles Davis didn't get to where to this level of reverence we have for him by being everybody else that was before, you know. I definitely totally believe in like learning what's come before you and having a history, but then you have to let it go. You have to let it go, and you have to everything that you need is inside you now. It is more a process of letting it out. I believe if used properly, the knowledge that we get and the technology and education and everything can be useful in helping you get these things out. But they're not, I don't find them useful in getting you to a place of creativity, a place where you're expressing yourself fully and wholly, you know? I mean, that's more of an internal journey. I mean, I have to learn more about myself. I have to have this acceptance of myself. I have to be a great viewer of what is outside of me and what happens in the world. And when you put and you bring that to your creative approach in the making of music to pictures, it's a really, really special thing when you feel like I can be whoever and whatever I want to be on demand. You know, and so much of the time we're in our heads. The most beautiful things that we've ever done didn't come from our heads, they came from our hearts. We come from our heart and bring it out to you. That's what true beauty is, not in the head. Not once I start thinking, then you're gone, you know. Opinion on the thing.
I agree completely. I teach writing. I am an English teacher. And what I usually tell my students is, you know, I'm going to give you the template on how to write. Once you get the template, it's your job to learn how to break out of it and do your own thing. But at least have the foundation first, so you know how to break out.
Yeah,
and that sounds
what
like
what is breaking out. I mean, a lot of people untrained are thinking that they're doing something new. And no, brother, it's just a shuffle. Not so, Jack Swing.
So when you're studying like musical history, the composers, I'm sure you studied all the great ones. Is there a major difference between what the music was at its core with Mozart and Beethoven to what composing of music is now with TV and movies and things of that nature?
I don't think the process is all that different, you know? I don't think what we go through to do it, you know, the turning ourselves ups and downs about whether this note or that note, the element of, you know, like in music to pictures, our job essentially is telling people what to feel, you know? That's the basis of it. You know, I mean, like I always explain it to folks, like a camera going down a dark hallway is not scary. It's not scary until we start going. Yeah. Now you know Pookie's getting ready to get off. You know, that's the basics of it, but you know, that's what we're doing. I was like, but these guys were doing it with operas and you know. All of that back in the day, they were just doing it in a live way, you know, and today we get to do it in so many ways with not only movies and TV shows, but then there's with video games and the whole like, and there's just all of the just short pieces that people are doing and that are just amazing. I mean, I see people do some interesting music together on a TikTok that just like, okay. In a few seconds, that's all right. That's pretty strong.
So do you ever have your music play for an orchestra in front of an audience, like at one of the opera houses or wherever like that, and have you performed?
We, there was a performance at the Television Academy a couple of years ago when they did the music of various television composers, and I was invited to be a part of that. And it was a lot of fun. It was great to see the other composers and to hear their music live and to see one of the pieces of music from a show I was doing, I think called Stitchers, and which is a very, very different and weird sort of score, you know, I don't know where it came from. And it was really cool to see it together with a live orchestra and with amazing Los Angeles musicians playing like that. And it's pretty exciting. I was just putting together, I'd done a show called Black Lightning, and just recently, though Black Lightning is no longer on the air, just recently we did put together a live orchestral suite of the music of Black Lightning, and I'm looking to get that performed out in a town near you soon.
Very cool, very cool. It was a fantastic show. And also the creator Tony Isabella is an awesome guy. So it was very cool to see that come live.
I loved doing this show. It was absolutely fantastic. What we got to do with that was something that was very unique and different. The producers Salim Akil and Marbrak Akil are just really brilliant in how they perceive music to be used in their various shows. And they really push you to go to another level and to look at things differently and actually allow you to do it. You know, I mean, that's you can, when somebody's looking at a composer's score or something, you always have to think of it also in the, what was he asked to do? You know, so saying whether that was great or, oh my God, that was bogus. That was so awful. What was he asked to do? What was he or she asked to do? What was the, because we are a cog in the wheel. We are, and the last cog almost to come up. You know what I mean? We guys are so impressed with what they do and how the importance of their music, but this, you know, this filmmaker or this, television writer may have been putting this whole project together for the last 5 or 10 years. And now you come in with all your musical brilliance and now, okay, it's going to be cool now. I got it. I'm going to fix all of this. you know, and I tend to not see it that way. I tend to want to know where they're coming from and what would it be if they could, if they heard music in their head all the time since they were three. What would it be? What would it be if they had an absolutely limitless budget, you know? And start figuring out and trying to get inside their head about what they were feeling, what were they listening to when they wrote this, you know? Mm. I mean, where's this character sound come from? You know, I'm generally riddling most of my producers and directors with a ton of questions that they probably weren't expecting, but that helps me unlock the key to the characters. You know, mm-hmm. I want to know what they know, what they're thinking, and if I'm doing it right, they are going to feel like, oh my God, it came from my heart, it mm-hmm. came from my soul. I was just working on a show called First Kill on Netflix, the producer, Felicia Henderson, just has a really wide range of musical tastes. And she's one of the producers that gets deeply involved with the music. And it's really, really interesting working with her because she really cares so deeply. I mean, music isn't just, hey, that thing that we slap on afterwards. Mm. It's literally in most of her pieces is a character in the show itself. And this score that we came up with was vastly different than most things that that I get to do and that she's had on her shows. And we just wanted to go for something just wildly different. I mean, we were doing tons of ideas with vocals, but a lot of times the vocals aren't what you thought were instruments, were actually vocals. You know, we were chopping it up, we were processing instruments to make them almost sound like a drum or something else. That there's one of them, we went so far, I remember the singer came in and I said, do you like what I did there? Did you see it? And that she had no idea of what was supposedly her, you know. I said, would you run that by me again? I said, no, see, that's you right there. And I took all the processing off and said, see, that's what you're saying. She's like, oh my God, this is crazy, you know. Mm. So it's a really, really interesting process. And one would ask, well, why would you take a perfectly good vocal track and make it sound like a synthesizer or make it sound like a drum or something else? I said, because now I get to experience that person's humanity. They bring their soul to this in a very different way. It may sound like a synthesizer, but she's not a keyboardist. And so she's not going to necessarily phrase it the way a keyboardist was. If it's a drum, she's not going to phrase the drum the way I'm a drummer. She's not going to phrase it the way I would, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's just going to have a little bit more of its own thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And that it was kind of just fun.
Well, I mean, your career has been immense. I read somewhere that you have scored more primetime shows than any African-American in history. Hmm. What does that mean to you? I mean, is there pressure in knowing that new composers that are looking to you for inspiration, and is there a responsibility in that to the next generation coming up trying to do what you do?
Well, it's really interesting deeply humbling to hear something like that back. You know, I mean, I never was never certain for sure that I'd be here. I haven't in the past a lot of times wanted to talk about what it is that I do and where and why. But I think it's important that young people see that there's a path for you. Hey, I was born in the projects on the deep south side of Chicago. You know, there's no reason for me to immediately think that I would be here talking with you now. Mm. But it happened. it happened. And if it can, and I started seeing the value in that, if it could happen for me, then you have to let, you have to start letting the next kid from Outgale Gardens, or the next kid that grew up in Cabrini Green, or the next kid that came from wherever, you know, that, yeah, you too can do this. This is as valid an option for you as it was for me. And there's no reason why you can't have this. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why you can't have anything that can come to your mind. If you're willing to work and put your soul into your heart and let it fly, then you can do this too. So but that's just my thought.
Well, having come from, like you said, the projects, what was it in you that you felt you had the confidence to do what you do and pursue what you pursue? Because once again, that's not an easy path that you chose. I mean, music composer, there's only so many that are, you know, that are out there successfully. Where did your confidence to do it come from?
Oh, I can't say that I necessarily had a confidence in that. I knew that there was something that was there for me. I mean, I was homeless and living on the streets, and I still thought there's going to be something for me. I used to run around saying, kid with a future. You know, I thought you'd be walking, when you're homeless and you're walking the streets all the time, you almost get hit by cars a lot. that's funny that you know that they don't tell you. and I'd never forget times when I'd almost get hit or something. I always say, kid with a future. And I was like, because I knew that there was something. I didn't know that there was this. I didn't come out here to be a television composer. I didn't watch TV or movies. But it happened. There was something that I knew was there for me. And I believed in me ultimately. I believed that this was just a momentary circumstance. I believed that there was something there and I was working towards it, but there was something in me that I had to fix. I started there. I said that there had to be something in me that wasn't clicking, that wasn't working, and that I had to take me out of the equation. And what I mean by that is, at the end of the year, when we're trying to add up what, when we're seeing the things that fell apart for me and this and then we're adding up, well, what worked and what didn't and why. And I was never going to be in that equation of why things didn't add it up to not working. I was going to take me out of the equation, which means that all of the things that I could control, look, I can't control if boss man, cousin Pookie has been sleeping on his couch for the last 6 weeks and they just flat tells him, you got to get rid of Pookie, you know, well, I've got a job for you, Pookie, you know, and there's nothing I'm going to be able to do about that. There's nothing I'm going to be able to do if somebody needs to put somebody else in that position, or for whatever reasons, this has to go somewhere else. But I'm always going to be the most prepared person you ever saw. I said I was going to be the person that was, you know, happy to be there at that job, you know, which matters. Hey, boys and girls, it matters. I said personally sit in a room in a dark, windowless room for 16 hours a day. It matters who's next to me. You know, it will matter who's going to have to hire you one day. And, you know, so I'm happy to be doing my job. I'm always prepared. I'm on time or early. I'm treating the people right. I said, people ask, like, how do you get so many jobs? How do you get so many hits? And this and that. I said, first of all, I only work for Steven Spielberg. I sworn that was John Williams, but you know, I'm walking with you on this one, brother. What's up? Yeah. You know, I said, well, you know, what I mean by that is whenever my director or my head producer walks in the room, I see Steven Spielberg and I act accordingly. None of the crap about, you know, attitude, none of the silliness about me. Hey, if Steven Spielberg was standing in front of you right now and telling you, okay, boys and girls, we're gonna be working late tonight. It'll be 4 in the morning before we're out of here. most of us wouldn't even remember to call our significant others to say we're not going to be home. I mean, you would just be, what do you need, Steve? What is it? Come on, brother, I got it for you. You know, the difference is, give that to all of your producers. Give that to everybody you work for. That's what I do. I'm starting there. I'm a ride this old treating them like Steven Spielberg thing on out and see where it take me. I think that the producers and the people that you work for feel it. And they're the ones that have to hire you. They're the ones that have to say, I want to work with him again and again and again, because he's committed. He's as committed as me. He's as serious as me about cracking this code. And that's what it is. It isn't a given that anything that we do is going to become a success. Not one. So why, you know, I mean, as far as I know, nobody's called me to program a network. So it doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter to anyone what my opinion is about the show that I'm working on, about the movie that I'm working on, about this TV series. I don't know. If I did, my butt would be bronzed and sitting out in front of Sony. He said, "Pull that away." You know, it doesn't work that way. So many things are involved in whether something succeeds or not, that when you see these people picking up an Academy Award or an Emmy and they're crying like babies, they mean it. They barely can believe that this thing even got done at all, let alone that it got done in this high of a quality that you decide you want to give this to me. You know, we don't know. So why don't you put your 110% effort in all the time, like you would if Steven Spielberg was in front of you? Come on. You don't know when at some point or another somebody worked on a first film with Steven Spielberg's.
Right.
Or an earlier picture. You didn't know. You did not know that that was going to, that a movie about a car and a truck dueling was going to be that big. You can't possibly. You can't possibly have 110% known that a movie about a big, obviously plastic shark was going to take over the entire world.
Right, 100%.
I mean, come on. To say that you knew that 100%, that was going to be it, you know, we don't always know. We don't always know. So put your efforts in. Bring you all the time. Nobody needs to know about your opinion about it, you know, unless you're becoming a writer and critic or a network exec, film exec, neither of which I plan to be in. I'm just gonna ride this old composer thing out and see where it takes me.
So my day job, I'm like I said, a high school teacher. I teach a special school for kids in rehab. Usually kids are trying to overcome drugs, alcohol, addictions, things of that nature. Oh, thank you. Most are from inner city, and almost all of them dream of being in the field of music. So if there was one thing that I could give them for advice to get them to where you are what would be the one thing I can tell them?
You can tell them this, that there is no one thing. There's not the one piece of music that you're going to write that's going to change your life. It tends to be, I did this and it got me there, and this got me that, and this one got this person to talk to me or to think about me, and so on and so forth. There is no one thing. There isn't the secret. Trust me. Where I came from, we used to talk about the secret that was going to make us be one of those monsters out at the coast, because that's what they were out from Chicago, Illinois. Everybody in New York was better than you. Everybody in LA was better than you. Heck, everybody in New Orleans was better than you. And so if you was at the coast, you were better than us. Well, you've got to change that up and know that you are special too. Instead of trying to reach for who we are, please turn inside and let you out. Let you out onto the world. nobody wants to hire you, the next person to sound like John Williams. You're not trying to get the next Blake Neely. They're not trying to hire somebody that comes and sounds like me. They're trying to get you for you. Mm. And only you can tell us who that is. Mm. Be completely and unabashedly you, joyously you, revel in the you-ness, revel in the downside and the upside. It is a journey. This is a journey we're on. I'm still on this journey. I'm still trying to figure it out, brothers and sisters. And you need to take stock of who you are and what you've decided to be on this journey. And just ride it on out. Ride it on out. Go in there and do not give up. 6 months before my breakout year, where I picked up some like 9 TV series in one season, I was giving up. I walked into my manager at that time and said, I'm done. I can't take it anymore. I can't take one more rejection. I can't take one more. Hey, just wait. Oh, you're really great, but you're really this, and it's going to happen. I couldn't take it. I was out of here. I had a plan. I was moving to, I was going to move to Vermont. Hi, Vermont. I love it there. I was gone. And six months later, I picked up 9 shows at once, new shows at the same time. So hang in there. When it's at its lowest, that is the floor you get to stand on to push off from, to see the skies, to see everything that you've ever dreamed of, and then some. Even I could not have dreamed of all of the, I did 22 different TV series and movies last year. This far in my career, I would never have figured that. I would have never have thought, oh yeah, sure. You know, go out and see what your journey is gonna be. Don't give up. And be honest with yourself. The biggest teacher that you can get is being honest with yourself. Telling you, I had a teacher one time, Johnny Lang, who used to, this was a great device. He would take you and one of your other friends that was like, if you're a drummer, you have to bring 2 drummers in there and say, okay, who's the best here? And if you went off and just said, oh, well, I kicked his butt, I'm not the fail, you know? If you were just, that was just great. He just does everything. It's just so fantastic. But you just effusively just went on and on about him. Fail. You didn't fail out of that. If you sat down and very, very meaningfully said, okay, well, Bubba's hands are stronger than mine. I've been working on it a lot, but if you see what his finger control is like there, it's really remarkable. But he can't touch anything that I'm doing with my feet. And by the way, I've got a really strong ability with independence that I think is better than him. His sight reading is good, but you know, you pick apart every little detail of what you do. A meaningful conversation of becoming from where? Honesty. Mm-hmm. Honesty. So if you can be so honest that you can say the things, he felt that if you could say the things that were good about you, but also the things that were not good about you and about anybody and anything else, then you had the ability to move yourself forward. Mm-hmm. We get hung up in the lie, in the fantasy, you know, the thinking that you're something that you're not, and thinking that things are something that they're not. Oh, there's all these crooks in entertainment and in Hollywood, and so that's why I couldn't make it. And you know, it's not a real job. Well, none of these are true. None of these things are true. If they were true, you'd have to go to that big green and white building in Burbank with the ears, with the mouse ears on top of it, and tell all of them to get out because they're not doing a real job. Hmm. You know, and when you were finished that, you should walk across the street to Warner Brothers and tell them to leave too, because they're not doing a real job either.
Yeah.
If you if you treat it like a business, it will treat you in kind. And it treats you in kind by giving you money. You know, you can't come into this field and treat it like a joke, showing up late, showing up with every stupid attitude in the world, without coming to it with some reverence and some professionality. If you do that, you're going to get what you're reaping from that. But if you say, I'm going to take this seriously, I'm going to treat this like this is the last thing chance I may ever have, you may tend to get to reap the benefits of that and do it with honesty. Geez, sometimes I'm not doing as good as I should be. I need to redouble my efforts. I have to be, where am I weak? What's the weak part of this score? And what's the great part? I want to show everybody, what's the part that just is barely skated through? Let's work on that too. Because I had to sit there and listen to hours of John Williams one time, going to Disney with my kids, and I had enough. And they said, well, Dad, you just sit here. And they sat me right where it was this whole Star Wars thing. And I'm just listening over and over and over all of this John Williams music and thinking, I'm not even in this business. Listen to this. Every minute of greatness, you know. So we want to strive to that. That's for sure.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spot just a little bit, and we kind of did this out if it's a no. On September, we do what we call Recovery Week, where we celebrate the students going through their, getting through their recovery. And we have guest speakers once a day to talk to them. If you would love to, if you're interested to talk to some students, I'm sure they would love to talk to you. So just like throw that out there for something to think about.
So. Oh, absolutely. I love it. I'm 2 years in recovery myself. So I'd be be glad to talk to any of them.
All right, so I think it's either in the second or third week of September that they'll do it. So when I get exact dates, I'll send them over to you. And I think they would love to hear some, because like I said, they all want to be musicians. You listen to them, you know, during the, like, what do you want to be? They're like, I'm going to be a rapper. I'm going to be a musician, whatever. And I'm like, well, it's possible. I mean, you got to work your ass off for it, but it's possible, you know?
Yes, it is if you have the real desire for the work, not just the results.
Right. Do you think that's what really is the difference between someone who's successful, someone who's not? It's not necessarily pure idea of pure talent. It's work ethic. That's the difference.
It's work ethic. But look, one thing that I have noticed is a similar trait in all of the people that I have met that are very successful in our business is when you're debating whether I should or shouldn't do this, or whether they're going to pay me this, or whether they're going to do that, most of the guys like me have already started the gig. We're already knee deep in it. I'm like halfway through the queues, you know. You're wondering whether somebody's going to rip you off. You're wondering whether somebody's going to do this. You're wondering whether I can do it. You're wondering all of this. And all of the guys and gals that I know that have succeeded, when you're thinking about that stuff, they're already working on it. Which proves the old adage, half of winning is showing up. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're not gonna show up and get to work, then, and a lot of us have this problem. A lot of us have self-doubt, such a mind-numbing self-doubt. We don't want to call it that. We don't want to say that we doubt ourselves. Nobody wants to think that they doubt ourselves, but all of us do to some degree or another. I know that I do, and it's the choice to overcome those doubts. And you know, if you actually start the job, then somebody has to say you either did it. It gives everybody a chance to say that you did it or not. If you actually finish a song, then if you notice that you ever had the musicians that say, "Oh no, I'm not finished. It's just a it's just a demo of it." No, hold it. No, it's finished for right now. So let's critique where it is right now. I'm sorry, you don't. If you never say it's finished, then none of my criticisms can really touch you, because you say, well, it wasn't done.
Right.
Finish. Jump in before everybody else. Finish something. finish it and move on to the next thing and learn something. It's each step along the way. And even if the thing that you learn is to not to do this again, or to not do that, or, oh boy, that didn't work. Or, and you learn something from everybody. I learned so much from people who are not even musicians, because all they're doing is telling you how it made them feel. They don't know anything about the flat nines and this, that, and the other, you know? Mm-hmm. They don't. They don't care. They don't care what you went through to get it. They listen to a record. They don't care about the drama, except for it as an interesting story later on in your life. But they do care about how it makes them feel when they're listening to it.
Mm.
Pretty much the only thing you should care about. So don't get all wrapped up in the minutia of what of your journey, of what went there, you know. Do it. The whole thing is, it's all a part of you. It's all a part of you. You're not supposed to want to cut off the difficult parts any more than you cut off the bright sunny days.
Mm.
All of it is what made you. So if there's someone that's in recovery or whatever, that went through the difficulties that led them to recovery, trust me, yeah, recovery are the brighter days. Trust me. It's the things that led you to there that are the dark days, and they're equally as important to not ever think about this and to not ever care about this is a direct path right into back into it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to accept. You know, this is a part of me and that's a part of me, and I have to give this a break. I have to, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of, once again, I guess the important question is, from a point of view of music, how far do you stretch your interest? Like, do you listen to music that you don't like, but it's a different style than yours? Like, do you listen to music that is not only classical, but maybe country, rap, rock? You go through all of it to pick something out from it.
Well, those who know me know that I love country and western music, that's my favorite music, oddly enough. And I find something interesting in all music, you know, everything from country and western to rap to, you know, rock and roll to whatever. I've never seen a musician that was special that I thought, oh, well, that's bogus and that has no validity. I said, yeah, it does have validity. People are listening to it and caring about it, you know? So let me find out why they care. What is it that's cool in this? If you leave your judgment at home, you might find what's cool in it.
So I
try to leave my judgment at home and just listen and just become a part of and be part of the movement and get involved, you know, with whatever the music is, you know? And then you start finding out, oh, geez, I'm 65 years old and I'm not that old guy that's saying that, you know, oh, turn that crap down. And if you only knew about it the way we did it in my day and why my day's music was so much better. So yeah, there's a lot of great things about that, but you want me to start picking out all of that? Absolutely fabulous things about today's music, about the craziest rappers, about the most fringe out there indie rock group, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm into all kinds of music, and whenever I got into a particular style of music, I noticed that I didn't hate the other music that I left behind, and that I didn't never really totally left it behind. It's already imprinted itself on me, you know. I went through a period when I was younger that I was totally into jazz, and I went through a period when I was totally into heavy metal. Ozzy Osbourne and his band when they first came out is what I was listening to. And Led Zeppelin, when they did their first tours of the US, I was there at Chicago Amphitheater, you know? And went on to listening to Miles Davis. I thought that that was cool. And you just find out what is special. What's special is something that's real. You know, someone had asked me if I thought that hip hop was a phase. I said, how could something that is coming up, bubbling up from the streets, that is a natural thing that people are doing for no money, going to be a fad? It seems to me more like it was a cultural statement. And here we are all of these years later, and it's arguably the number one music in the world. You know, you can't get away from it. There's nothing that hasn't been influenced by it, from from the music itself to the look, to the way these guys dress, has influenced everybody. So, you know, just look for something that's real. Look for something that's musically real, and try to find out what is the realness in it. What's the spark? What makes you care? And maybe you can learn something from that. Mm-hmm. I find out all these elements popping up in my music all the time, and I think it's kind of fun, and I kind of giggle at it when it does.
So when you get to the point when you get the job, okay. So once again, you've had so many different a great variety of different projects. So for instance, when you have, let's say, a project like First Kill, for instance, okay, and you know you're giving the idea of the story, how are you developing the theme for that kind of story, and like how do you find the essence of a project and know how you want to develop the music for? And it, I assume the music you're making is specific for the project's not, you know.
Yeah, a lot of talking with the producers or directors or writers. I insist upon reading the script, even if the pitch is already shot. I like to read the script because I want to be on the journey as much as I can from the beginning with them. You know, I want to take the journeys that they took. Maybe we'll end up at the same place together. You know, as much as I can. I bombard them with tons and tons of questions about characters, about storylines, about feelings and emotions that are going on there, you know, and what they are trying to get to, what they're trying to express at that moment. And if I come at it from that direction, I end up being a little bit closer to what they wanted to do, which is the place to be, you know?
So when you're, let's say, when you get on a difference between a TV show and a movie is that a movie is, once again, one film. A TV show is multiple different episodes. So when you start on the project, let's say, for instance, First Kill, do you ask where the characters are going, where the show is going? Does that influence what you do in one? Does?
Yes, absolutely. There are things that you need to know that Pookie is actually that's the small character here needs to have this thing because he's going to be Luke Skywalker, basically. You didn't know that Luke Skywalker was ultimately this big character later, you know. Yep. So there's been sometimes I've started just little strains, a few notes of what becomes a big orchestral theme later, you know. In the case of the First Kill, there were so many. I don't think that anybody could have guessed how that first season was going to end. It was, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but I do say if you're out there and you've started watching it, and you say you watched three or four episodes and you think you know, I can tell you, you have no freaking idea. You couldn't possibly. It's very shocking, and so you will find out why I started building this theme earlier that becomes everything in the eighth and final episode, season finale. So you know, yeah, you're thinking those sorts of things all along, and it's interesting how you know, some producers will talk to you about where they're going, story arc over years, you know, say, you know, that eventually so-and-so is going to become blah, blah, blah. I said, oh yeah, that's good to know. You know, and at the same time, you can't jump ahead. You don't want to necessarily give that away. You got to live in the moment of where they are today, where they are in the journey now, you know. In the Black Lightning, I knew early on that the daughters were going to become superheroes and that, and which one was going to be coming out first and showing her powers and all of that. And I started dropping little musical hints of what she, what would ultimately become her big hero theme, which in the last, I think is the last or next to last episode in season one, becomes, you know, becomes a huge anthemic sort of piece of music in a battle with her and one of their main nemesis while her father was fighting Tobias Well. And by this point now, this cute little piano cue has become, is now turned into this big, which I knew it was always going to be, this big anthemic heavy metal rock sort of thing that was going on there. And you're like, oh, shoot. And then it took a few people a while to look back and say, oh my God, that was that same little theme that was, you know,
yeah,
that we were tinkering around with for several episodes, for half the season almost.
That's also, I mean, and in the first kill on your, on the soundtrack, you have a piece called Oliver. Is that kind of how you approach that one as well? Because once again, it's directed to a specific character. You're developed a theme for that particular character. And when you work on the other, when he appears in other scenes, are you working in that theme as well to carry over through across those?
That is an interesting thing. Yes. And yes, they, I know that there are going to be some interesting things that are going to happen with Oliver in coming seasons. So whenever that is announced, but I needed to give him a certain sort of darkness and a edge, and we'll see where that takes us. But it's in its much more simplistic form right now, and that's going to grow into something. Yes, you're Obi-Wan Kenobi has taught you well.
Thank you. So when you're doing your composition for a particular, piece for the, like I said, first skill, for instance, how do you know when it's finished? How do you know that it's exactly at the point where you needed to take it?
I go through this process, and thank you for asking that. I always tell my young assistants, I'll say, you know, if you are writing more than you're listening, then you're doing it, then something is wrong. Something is going to get screwed up. I spend a lot of times listening to the scores. I'm watching the picture, listening. I go into different areas of the room and listening to it from over here. I listen to it at different volumes, different levels. I go into other rooms, like I was in the kitchen or something, you know. Well, but I was hearing this show in the other room, and I want to see what it would sound like from there. I'm listening from all sorts of levels to give me perspective. Mm. And when I am no longer, and I come back after listening to that, and I may make me add something or take something away, and when I finally can listen to it and I only feel like a fan, nothing is making me feel that urge to add something or take something away, that I feel like it's, and nothing is bumping me, that I'm just now, I'm not focused on the music, I'm only focused on the scene and the characters and what they're saying, what they're trying to emote, and it feels like one, then I'm done. Except for if a producer or director comes in and says, that's crap, we gotta change it all. We gotta change it all. And then I'm not, and then mystically I'm not done. But so, I think if I do that right, I generally have less notes like that.
Now, when you get feedback from a director or producer or whatever, is it sometimes just tweak this or that, or is it sometimes, you may not realize what's going on with this character, you may want to consider this, like how does it usually come?
D, all the above. I was in First Kill recently, there was a very heavily effects laden area And what it looked like and what they had told me initially are not what it looked like when they got the full effects like several months later. And we basically had to rewrite everything. It did not have the girth and the intensity for what they had coming off the screen. I have a tendency to get less notes only because I'm not writing the music for me, you know, and I don't take their notes and the things that they say lightly. I try to try to see how we can make sense of it, you know, and see it through the eye of this composer as opposed to that composer, you know. So I have to take it through the eyes of Kurt Farquhar, you know, and achieve what it is that they're saying, you know. And I genuinely see us as collaborators. When a producer comes in, I'm not thinking, oh, this idiot doesn't understand, you know, nothing of my work, even though I start off by telling them all that. Even before you get started. But, you know, I also tell all of my producers and directors, I said, you know that little, that thing where, you know, an artist is just very uncomfortable about, you know, somebody talking about their work or whatever. Yeah, well, I don't have that. It fell out of me sometime in the 70s. So you might as well go straight for what you want to say as aggressively as you want to say it. You want to say specifically that that's crap and this is why this doesn't work. Absolutely none of it for this thing. Go ahead and tell me that and we can get to what you want quicker. You know, I just don't have, these are not my babies. I always tell them my babies are at home and at school in San Marino. At least I hope they were. And this, you know, as much as I love it, I'll do whatever you need, whatever it's going to take to make this scene real for you, to make it sing the way you want it to. So
where can our listeners find your soundtrack and First Kill, the series?
First Kill is on Netflix, and watch and binge it to the end. I'm telling you, you're not gonna believe that that ending on that. And the soundtrack is out everywhere. You can see it on Spotify and Apple Music and Amazon Music, and it's virtually everywhere. And please check it out. It's a lot of fun. Download it, buy the music, you know, do it old school, you know, and share it with your friends. It's a lot of fun. It's a wonderful piece. I was telling everybody, I said, although this gets lost on some of the young ones, I said, this is my Dark Side of the Moon.
Oh, I love that album.
So you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, I know Dark Side of the Moon. It's fantastic. Yeah. Eclipse, perfect.
This is my Dark Side of the Moon. It's an epic journey. So please check it out.
Well, thank you so much, sir. You were fantastic to talk to, and it was a great pleasure, sir.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate that you found me relevant to talk to, and I'm so proud to be here and chat with you about something I love so much.
Well, thank you so much, and you'll hear back from me about the.
Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. Bye bye.